Just a few words on the Bodhisattva precepts in general. Tenzin Roshi, in Being Upright, says, for the Zen practitioner, the Bodhisattva precepts are not a side issue. They are at the core of the process of awakening. As Suzuki Roshi said, receiving the precepts is a way to help us understand what it means to just sit. And then he says, this integration of precept practice and meditation practice is what he means by being upright, the title of the book. So it's a nice term, literally being upright in body, but being upright in conduct. And being upright in the mind of presence, all of that together, really. And I found it in one of these articles on Bodhisattva precepts, an old Zen monk from around Dogen's time, in an essay on the precepts, said, Bodhidharma said, one whose behavior and understanding correspond is called an ancestor, a Zen ancestor. I thought that's a nice, simple, non-esoteric way to talk about this, is one whose behavior and understanding correspond. So we might say, I really understand that that we're all really not separate and just one being, but the way I actually relate to others isn't that way. We might say, we all are in accord at times and not in accord at times. We could say, at the time when the understanding and behavior are in accord, at that time when's a Zen ancestor, and even maybe when they're not in accord, you could say, they're not really a Zen ancestor at that time. But I thought that's a nice way to put it. And a Buddha, of course, is that way, right? Their understanding and behavior. Or actions in the world are just one whole, not like out of accord with each other. And this is another nice part, I thought, here. This is just in Being Upright, this section on the 10 grave precepts, kind of introduction to all 10.
Why are they called grave?
Grave. I mean, this is Chinese character that is usually translated as grave or heavy or major, we could say. And particularly it's in this Brahmajala Sutra. Remember there's these 10 major and then 48 minor precepts. So literally the character is more like grave or heavy, and the one for minor precepts, the character means like light, lighter weight. So it's maybe just the way the Chinese put it. So we still sometimes use that word grave. I don't like to use the word so much because it sounds so grave.
Serious.
Yeah, serious, maybe another one. I think that's what a grave means. Yeah.
Major
is nice because it's kind of, well, even though we don't have minor in our tradition.
More important, less important.
Yeah.
Still important, but not as important.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, like our list, we have... We have the three pure precepts and then the 10 grave precepts when we list them like that. So it's nice to have some word to distinguish these different sets of precepts. Major or... I've also seen it translated as prohibitory, 10 prohibitory precepts. I think the character might have some connotation like that.
There was another book by a woman, Diane something. She had a different version. It was really nice, but I can't remember. You know what I'm talking about? Diane. She might have been with the
Bandage?
Maybe.
Bandage?
Yeah, maybe. I think she was from Joko Beck's.
And in the positive, I don't know what that was, but yeah, there are many different kind of modern ways to try to call them something. Also, the Bodhidharma, one mind precepts, is a maybe more positive way to put it. And I've also heard them called clear mind precepts. the 10 clear mind precepts. It's not a translation, but it's a nice... Yeah.
Here they certainly are all prohibitory.
Yeah, 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 they're all in negatives.
And the minors are negatives.
Also, no, they also are, like... Yeah, oh, well, that's a good question. In fact, I think maybe they're not. They're a little bit... Maybe some are more positive sides, more like making vows and commitments is some of them. So I think you're right, actually.
Because otherwise yeah. It wouldn't be a reasonable distinction.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's right. These all have negative, and part of the negative, they all have, you know, really the not before them often. And I put no here because if we're Bodhidharma's one mind precepts, creatively takes up this fact that they all have a negative before them in just the way that the Heart Sutra has a negative before all these terms and brings out this ultimate meaning of the precepts that, like, there is no killing, realization of you know, no duality between birth and death, for example, is like the ultimate one mind precept. And then, so no killing... On the ultimate level, there is no killing, but then we practice on the relative level, no killing. So I think it's a Zen thing to pick up on that, using the negative preposition as a kind of emptiness teaching. So it's kind of nice that they're negatives for that reason. Even though I think long before that, the Prajnaparamita sutras came out, there were already these, in the Buddha's time, they were negative, more like what we're refraining from. So here he's using the term grave precepts. Welcome. So Tenshin Roshi says, in interpreting the meaning of one of these 10 major precepts, perhaps the most helpful and readily available commentary is the other 9. For example, if in contemplating a sexual relationship, you're unsure whether sexual greed is involved, which is one translation of the 3rd precept, consider if there's any intention to deceive others about this aspect of the relationship. That would be the lying, not, you know, speaking falsely part. Inquire whether there's an urge to intoxicate or to take what's not given, to be possessive or to express anger. Right? All these things come up around this one, any one precept. In violating one of the precepts, all the others are violated, if only subtly. In fully realizing one of the precepts, the others are upheld. And I think it's so true. We can think of so many examples like this, yeah, that they kind of feed on each other.
Selfish versus self.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we start, you know, the others start coming into play. Once we start going down a selfish track, all kinds of other selfishness starts to ensue.
Then likewise the other side.
Yeah, and the other side too. Yeah, when we're really clear about one, then the others are sort of are taken care of. And another way that all 10 relate together, he says here, similarly, if you feel an overwhelming certainty to the point of self-righteousness about the meaning of one precept, contemplating how the other 9 apply may be helpful in gaining a wider perspective. Examining one precept through the lens of the others may broaden your compassionate view of that precept. Consulting the other precepts protects you from a narrow understanding and supports the realization of their complete meaning. Finally, meditating on the interdependence and mutual support of these 10 precepts shows that no individual precept has any independent, fixed meaning. I think it's a meditation practice, you know, to take each precept in itself. And so I thought of an example there would be, say, like, not killing means, like, you're vegan, right? You have to be vegan. And anyone who's not is just wrong. So then now we're into, like, discussing the faults of others, right? We're speaking of others' faults because it's like holding this one so strongly. then I'm breaking the other ones. Yeah. So I think that's this kind of thing is like seeing that they're all interdependent and none of them have like a fixed, definitive, unbreakable identity, that precept. And then following on this theme, Tenzin Roshi says, in a sangha, the complacent people, complacent around the precepts, I think he means, have to bump up against the fanatics. And the fanatics have to run up against the complacent people. Each group can learn from the other. The fanatics need to relax more, and the complacent people need to open up to the anxiety of the self-righteous fanatics. The more mature and balanced people in the community can help those who are leaning to either one of the extremes. So I think it's just, they're not ever clear cut. It's not like, here's the definitive precept and everybody should be following it, and if they're not, they're wrong. It's like, that's maybe the, can be almost fanatical. And so the community, right, where we talk about these together, which we can do in this class, we keep things in balance, and in the end maybe we find that there's no, it just brings up more questions than answers about any precept. But by discussing it, we all kind of maybe find the middle way, whatever extreme we're on, more. So that's some, I think, a good meditation on these precepts.
Seems like one could be a fanatic, but not proselytizing about it. I mean, that really
yes.
You have to be a fanatic
yeah.
for these guidelines
yep.
for yourself.
You have to be? You could be.
For the path, on the path.
We have to, I think, look really deeply and question deeply. Maybe fanatically inquiring.
Right.
I think especially, yeah. Yeah, and then I think you're right. You can be really, really into for yourself without proselytizing or pushing it on others. But then I think it's very hard, and people have told me about this, when they're really working on some precept really strongly, even if they're not trying to and they're being very careful not to, they start noticing the faults of others, or that other people really, almost like when we're making a great effort, we start to feel like, why aren't other people making as great an effort? It's so natural to feel that way. And I
work on that.
Yeah, then you work on that. Yeah. So that's the best. I think that's the best. And I, you know, that's been part of my practice history personally, is being on the self-righteous side. And our author here, Tenzin Roshi, my teacher, would, it's one thing he would just constantly, the first few years of practice, especially for me, practicing with him, that was like, the feedback I was constantly getting is like, it was often around ethical stuff. I came into Zen Center with a lot of like, we really have to like, let's live perfectly in this world. And he said, he never criticized it as being like, you shouldn't be so fanatical. He would say, that is so beautiful, you want to live that way. But you should live that way because you think it's beautiful. And if other people don't think it's so beautiful, or if they can't for some reason, then that's fine. Then, you know. But if you feel like, well, maybe I have some doubt whether it's just beautiful for me or not, and I'm like, I want other people to support me to do it because I'm having a hard time doing it, then, and why don't they help me more? Then it's maybe like, I don't really see that it's beautiful to me, and I don't care whether anybody practices this way because I want to. I think that's what he was promoting, is then you're kind of safe.
Was
you're,
that the case for you?
It was a good meditation for me.
Like in your head, mm-hmm. were you asking other people to support you?
I think, unconsciously. I wasn't necessarily verbally telling them to, but sometimes, especially if I was doing something that was a little outside what the group was doing, but I felt like I'm trying to follow this precept, or even like other monastic precepts that we don't even have in our Bodhisattva precepts, and thinking, but we're a monastery, and if we're ordained, we should follow all of this, even if it's not in our manual or something. And he said, and he was always supportive of that, as long as don't feel that that, well, everybody else is lacking or something. So I think, and it was a great instruction for me, because it would keep me honest. Like, if I really enjoy this for my own sake because it's beautiful, then I really don't have a problem with what other people are doing. Unless, maybe if they're extremely causing harm to others, which we can get into that, then I could have a problem out of compassion for the ones being hurt or something. But often it was more like maybe I'm not 100% behind it myself, but if everybody around me is doing it too, then I don't need to think about that. I can. So in a way, it's kind of nice when the world is not supporting us outwardly to follow these precepts, because then we get to see, is it really because I love to do this and I'm committed to it or not? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's harder, but it's a good test.
Yeah, it seems true, like once we have a standard, I'm just, you know, what comes up for me is I'm fanatical about my house and maintaining it and all that. And I notice my judgment, you know, although I would never say anything and I realize it's their house, but you know, when it's like piles of trash and it's not being maintained, I'm like, whoa, my neighbor is like, what's up with that?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's a good way to practice. It's not exactly a precept thing there, I think, but it's you could say, that's a good chance to look at, I like to keep my house beautiful because that's just my value. And it's not like it's a better value. We can easily get into it. Yeah. It's not better. With ethical precepts, it's even easier to get into thinking it's a better value, right? Because of the Buddha's precepts, and they're about harming others. So it's harder than just style of keeping a clean house, I think.
It is a value.
And I think in all cases, it's like, I keep my value, even when the world seems to be doing something totally different. And it shows how strong our value is. Often it's like, well, maybe my value is just diluted, even though it seems, in my heart it feels right, but maybe I'm off because the people around me seem to be like, doing all kinds of stuff like this. And then it sort of tests our, do we go with the world, which is, you know, from the Buddha's perspective, most of the world is totally crazy and deluded, actually. So, or do we find a new standard that maybe looks crazy to other people? And then together we find the middle way, hopefully. So, another point about these bodhisattva precepts that's, I think, related to this last week, talking about this, the way the bodhisattva precepts are like Buddha nature precepts. They're sometimes called Buddha mind precepts. They're actually a description of our true nature, right? The way our true nature works in the world, as opposed to like maybe monastic precepts that are a lot of detailed rules of conduct that apply to Indian culture, for example, or just to training certain selfish tendencies, but that they might not be, they're not considered Buddha nature precepts. And these so-called Hinayana or monastic Shravaka precepts are received just for, you know, they're within time. You can receive them, and this is still true in Theravada Buddhism. You can get ordained as a monk, and then you can stop, and there's a little ceremony to take off the robe and give the precepts back, basically. You can pick them up and put them down multiple times during your lifetime. And it's actually very common in Thailand, for example, to do these temporary ordinations. I think almost all the men in Thailand, they're kind of expected to be a fully ordained monk with 200 precepts for like a few months in their life. Which I think is a great practice. They really get to see what that's like, and they know they're not going to do it forever. And the precepts are much stricter than ours in many ways. And then they give them back again. Whereas the bodhisattva precepts, which are the same for lay people and monks and priests, are forever. Like, you can't actually give them back. You could, according to the sutras, actually, the bodhisattva precepts, teachings are like, you can say, I'm done with these precepts, I'm burned my rakasu, and I'm doing something else now. But in fact, the teaching is like, it's too late. you're infected. Yeah. The virus is in your system. And not even for this lifetime, but for all the lifetimes to come, you have them for eternity. So in fact, when we receive them in a ceremony in this life, it may be that we received them like many, many lifetimes ago or something, and we're just renewing it. So you could say that's this part of the spirit of the Mahayana, but I think it's an interesting difference in the understanding of these precepts. They're like, in a way, I think it's pointing out that they are our true nature already, so how can we get rid of them? We can go against them, but now we understand that our true nature is non-separation between self and others. Therefore, now we know that when we're harming others in these 10 ways, that we're kind of going against reality. And that will always be the case. Yes?
Is there a positive statement of these? For instance, no stealing, you can just dana them giving, which
yeah.
is one of the precepts, and then go through them all and yeah. take them in a
yeah. way. Yeah, there are.
It's really, good.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be curious to see that.
Yeah, people have come up with, in the Asian tradition, I've never seen it in the tradition, but in America, I've seen people put the positive side because the negative can sound too negative.
Yeah.
So not killing but protecting life
yes.
would be the first. And let's try to remember as we go through each of them to think of the positive version.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Let's try to look up, her name's Diane Rizzuto.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I'll look it up, I'll have a different. It's
yeah.
It's kind of more positive work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I think we can remember too of the, and we can I think discover on our own a positive version for each of them. So I think protecting life is a good one for not killing.
We used to have a picture in the office.
Yeah, yeah, there was.
Dismantled, that had both the positive version and the negative version
mm-hmm.
superimposed on each other.
Mm-hmm.
In different colors.
Yeah. Yeah, it might be still around somewhere. So the first, not killing life, and in fact the Brahmajala Sutra, the source of these precepts, which looking at the Chinese, they don't have title headlines actually, but commentators later put in, a one line title for each of the precepts. And they're pretty much identical to Dogen. When Dogen lists the precepts in the Shobogenzo, he's got a chapter on them called Shobogenzo Jukai. And, the Kyodru Kaimon is another essay of Dogen. And then the ordination manuals of Dogen all have these, they're slightly different sometimes, but they're virtually the same. Brahmajala Sutra, 10 precepts. So these bold-faced titles are, I think I used as close as I could find to a nice English translation of Dogen's precepts from the Chinese. So this one is literally, there's three characters here. Not kill life. So, but the sutra says, maybe you haven't ever heard this, the sutra version, it's a little bit longer. So I thought we could read as we go into each precept. This one is, a disciple of Buddha does not kill. And, in our, full moon ceremony, that's the language we use. And that's not there in the, I don't think in the Soto Zen, Ryaku Fusatsu ceremony, that is our full moon ceremony, very traditional, but there's, sometimes I think they just read the Kyodu Kaimon in Japan. Which is all Dogen's comments on the precepts. But this language of, we say, a disciple of Buddha does not kill life. Right? And I think that comes from the sutra, that somebody in America, I think at San Francisco Zen Center, is saying instead of "I vow not to kill," I think they're pulling from this translation. So literally the sutra says, a disciple of Buddha does not kill. Encourage others to kill. Kill by expedient means. Praise killing. Rejoice at witnessing killing. Or kill through incantation or deviant mantras.
Wow.
Maybe that was... We don't get into that so much in America, but maybe in the old days. Yeah. Deviant mantras would be like, with, you know, their mantras have power to create change. So maybe in India particularly, it'd be like black magic. Maybe we'd say black magic in our culture. One must not create the causes, conditions, methods, or karma of killing, and must not intentionally kill any living being. A bodhisattva ought to nurture a constant mind of kindness, compassion, and devotion, always devising expedient means to rescue and protect all beings. If instead one fails to restrain oneself and kills sentient beings without mercy, one commits a parajika offense. And that's Vinaya language that got brought into the precepts. Parajika just means like a major, like I think it literally means defeat. One is like defeated in this precept. So it just emphasizing that there's a going against the spirit of this. So that's this precept. And I think there's lots of ways this this applies, yeah. So, and there's not some nice examples in being upright. And first of all, I thought in the human realm, we can get into animals too. In the human realm, it's really like a timely thing right now because, like, on our voting ballot, you can vote for killing humans or not, right? The death penalty.
Oh, yeah.
Is on the ballot, and
eliminate. Yeah,
to eliminate. Right now, we have a law that allows the killing of humans. It's kind of a strange thing.
They also just passed the Compassionate End of Life Act, where you can kill yourself if you're in so much pain, or you're going to die within the next like 6 months or something. I don't know exactly what the rules are, but they just passed it, so you can.
Is that a state law?
Yeah, state. It's in California and Oregon, I think.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard you said that various hospices don't always have, like, they won't encourage it or they won't participate in some hospice, but you can, it's a law, and you can do it yourself. But
That's interesting. I wonder what, I feel like traditionally this would... That would be a violation of this. It seems to me if you read it to a letter.
Yeah,
I'm
so.
Not sure. I don't know. I'm sort of in.
The commentaries.
I'll find myself that's in favor of that kind of the.
End of life.
Yeah, but it's interesting.
Usually they say, this is another difference between the Shravaka monastic precepts from the early tradition. Are, and this is still true in modern times, like in Thailand, for example, those precepts are like totally to the letter. It's all about very literal, and there's this big, you know, rule books that we have in the library here. You can read for the monks and the nuns, describing all, like it's like a legal code, you know. And there's hundreds of precepts, but each one has pages of commentary of describing what goes against and literally for it. And there's some things that actually do go against the spirit of the precept, but they don't literally violate it. There's like loopholes, you know. But that's the spirit of those ones, is they're very literal. And I think there's something beautiful about that approach, because it's just very clear cut. And it's just like, this is what it is and this isn't. And it trains the mind in a certain way. But the bodhisattva precepts in the Mahayana, going way back to the time of Asanga and other in the 4th century and others, the commentaries say these bodhisattva precepts are not to be followed necessarily literally. They're all about compassion and not harming others. So, you know, the classic examples are like, you know, not lying would be like the Theravada version of not lying would be like, no matter what, you just never tell something falsely. Even if it hurts somebody, you just never break that because there's no wiggle room. Whereas even in ancient times in India, the Bodhisattva precept is like, well, if there's an innocent person, say, hiding in your house and a murderer comes looking for them, and are they here? And you lie. You say, no, they're not here to protect them. So you break the literal precept to protect life. And they say that actually, so you're literally lying, but they say that is upholding the precept of not lying. You're actually not breaking the lying precept in that case, even though literally you are. And each of these 10, actually, we went through this in the class on Asanga a couple years ago. He quite beautifully comes up with an example for each one of these 10, or it's the 10 wholesome actions, so they're very similar. And reasons why, sometimes pretty far-fetched reasons, but why a bodhisattva might go against the literal meaning to benefit others. So that's to your point, Arya, that's the spirit of these, even though here's the version of it. So that's why there's no definitive fixed thing about it. And together we can question. So like the death penalty, I think the people who would support it would be saying, we're trying to actually prevent killing of other innocent lives, right? If we make this really strong punishment of death that will prevent murders, that's, I think, what some would say, and I think there's studies that say it probably won't really prevent murders. But I think...
It's also the cost, I think. The cost of keeping people.
Yeah, and there's a cost issue in there.
Especially if they're never going to get out.
Although I heard, tell me if I'm wrong, but because it's on the ballot now, right? I think they'd say, if by eliminating the death penalty, it will save millions of dollars in legal costs. And I was surprised because I thought, wouldn't it cost more to support someone's food and medical care for like 50 years maybe sometimes in prison rather than just like do a quick execution?
Right, but that's the reality, it's going to take so long because there's appeal.
Yeah, and it'll cost so much.
15 years of legal.
And it costs the state that money, right?
So
the other point is
you have to be housed in special units,
yeah,
and monitored in a special way for decades.
Yeah.
I think California has only executed like 6 people in the last decade or
not so often because it takes so much. But yeah, I feel that in the spirit of this precept, really, is that it's just no matter how horrible something's been done, if you just do the same thing back, it's just like you're just doing the same thing that you're saying they shouldn't do. That's so it's not that I would necessarily always say there's never any possible exceptions to not killing being a problem or the compassionate thing. But I think it's on the ballot because it's, I think it didn't, it was on the ballot before, I think it didn't pass. I think as I recall.
That's true, I think that's right.
Yeah. I was surprised too. People really want there to be the death penalty. So it's something to consider in light of this precept of what's, is killing ever beneficial? I think the example, as I recall, that Asanga brings up in the 4th century about breaking the literal to keep the spirit of it is this crazy story of this ship is out at sea. You might have heard this story. I think it's like, You, the bodhisattva, are on the ship, and there's a deranged ship captain, and he has this plan because he told you that he's going to kill all the 500 passengers on the ship, and in this fanciful imaginary situation, there's no way that you can just restrain him somehow, because that would be the best, right? You just tie him up and take away his weapons. But in, we can imagine some story where there's no way to stop him except to kill him. Now, we don't need to get into all the details of why that would be. Yeah, something like this. But if there really were no other way, then Asanga says, then the Bodhisattva would actually compassionately kill this captain. And interestingly, he adds in the part that it's also, this is a kind of an interesting Buddhist twist on this, it's also beneficial to the captain to kill him, because the karma he will receive from killing these hundreds of people will be like incredibly bad for his evolution over all these future lives. He'll never have a human life, probably. He'll be born in like hell realms, and you're actually saving him from these lower realms by preventing his karma. And you take on a little bit yourself, and you're actually willing to, maybe you spend a little time in hell just from this activity. Yeah. It's a little bit like this. Yeah.
It's and I get this from Steven Pinker. I don't know if anybody's read Steven Pinker. The one I get this from, the book is called The Better Angels of Our Nature. Mm. So it's almost like the goalpost, especially over the last few hundred years. I mean, because it's thou shalt not kill too. I mean, mm-hmm. So we're talking very old stuff. But
that's all religions.
But how we look at, and that we're getting better and better. It's a very optimistic book, because if you look at how many hangings and executions, and public witnessing of those, and, you know, that really in all realms, whether it's in domestic violence, how we treat children, in all these ways, and even more, that hopefully we continue to get better. So this is another example of that with the death penalty.
Yeah.
That we would... just takes a little time.
Yeah.
And eventually, we'll be there. Huh?
May it be so. Yeah. And of course, there's other countries that have like major torture. I mean, some would say America still does torture too. But
that's
right. So at least even with death penalty, they look for more and more humane ways to kill people. Although when I hear about them, they don't sound so great. So we have that, and then you all brought up euthanasia. Also, Tenshin Roshi brings up is another interesting application of this precept, which is not clear-cut, right? Where people are really suffering, people or animals, right, are really suffering. Do we put them out of their misery and take their life, especially if they're requesting it? And again, if from the compassionate point of view, I think it's clear when people are requesting it themselves, like you say, you can take your own life or maybe have people assist you. I really am ready to go now. And in a compassionate way, maybe okay. I think with other people, it's if they don't have an end-of-life directive, it's harder to tell. And especially I have a question it with pets. There's a lot of, it's almost like the norm to put down pets when near the end of their life, when they seem to be suffering. And I don't know. I don't have a definitive thing, but I think it's hard to know where they're at because they can't tell us. And sometimes it may be more for their human owner to get out of their misery by like not having to watch this unknown misery. And
I think generally though for a pet owner, it's hard for them to do that.
Yeah, of course it's hard. Yeah.
Maybe not have the best judgment, but I think their intentions get, if they have
my aunt
has a dog that's getting old, it's getting arthritis, can't even go on the couch now. Sometimes she just labors over it, but it would kill her if he died, but she doesn't suffer, so she has this challenge with it.
Yeah. The example in Being Upright, if you've read this around this kind of thing, is a much more extreme story at Green Gulch. This deer caught in a fence, and one of the farmers, I think, and it had broken its leg. Obviously, it had broken its leg. It wouldn't be able to walk, but it was peacefully resting there, still caught in the fence with this broken leg. And one of the garden farmers came over and said, I think it's time to put it out of its misery. And could you, Reb, come and, as a priest, witness this, and maybe do a little ceremony here? They were all Zen practitioners, right? But we feel compassionately like we should end its life. It can't go on like this. And so, and the way he did it was with an axe. And so Reb was there and watched the first axe to the neck. It didn't work, right? It didn't go through. And then the deer that was very peaceful before is now freaking out and was like totally struggling, and like the pain of this, like, you know, chopping and chopping at the neck of this deer. And that's when Reb said afterwards, he's like, I really thought that at first this was a good decision. And then at the end, I thought this was not the way to go with this. Yeah, and maybe get the vet out. You know, I wonder about maybe even you carry the deer off into the hillside and you let it die just as it would in nature, slowly. And someone was just telling me about how Pema Osaling, our neighbor, Vajrayana community, their sort of like recommendation for the pets dying, and I think people too, but especially for animals, and of course they have a much more heightened view of this rebirth process and karma process that we have too, but we don't emphasize so much. Their take is however much struggle there is, that's part of the process of all beings dying, and to like let that happen as naturally as possible. And it's just part of this long, it's just going to keep going life after life, and there's some sort of karmic purification maybe, even if it's a difficult, painful struggle. And if you take that away from the struggling being, you maybe are not helping them evolve the way they most appropriately would. So that's interesting, that kind of take on it. Almost like the most natural, the better.
So they could have just left the deer.
Yeah.
They didn't even have to carry it anymore.
Yeah, maybe even leave it in the fence, and once it dies,
probably... I got stuck in the fence.
Yeah. So of starvation or thirst, or maybe you even give it water.
That's what I was thinking. The best kept secret about dying is just stop drinking.
Yeah.
Stop drinking.
I think...
It's a terrible story.
It's
very disturbing.
I was just thinking
because we had the interfaith thing, Judaism weighs in on this in an interesting way, which it says you're allowed to eat meat, and that's a thing, and it's like a gift from God. But you must, whenever you kill an animal, you must do everything you can to ensure that you kill it in the most humane, in the way that causes the absolute least suffering. So in fact, actually, you're trained in how to kill the animal properly.
The butchers would be too.
It's like a specially trained person works and is like, yeah, trained. So like,
and that was what makes it kosher?
Like a hatchet, for example. Yeah, it's not kosher unless the animal is like killed in a very particular
interesting
way.
Yeah.
And it's actually controversial now because maybe the traditional method isn't as good as some modern methods, but even then there still is this like really... There's this imperative anyway that's higher than maybe other people.
So an Orthodox Jew couldn't like go to McDonald's, for example, or eat non-kosher meat.
Yeah, I mean it would be for like a lot of reasons, but that would be among them. Yeah, I forget the name of the person that does it, but there wasn't a special person did this
honor. Yeah. A Native American tradition, we hear stories like that too, right? There's this relationship built on the hunt with the animal before killing it. Yeah. Nettie, you had a question, a point?
Well, I was thinking for the back of my book about euthanasia with animals and with humans, and just, you said about the Maasai and just letting it happen naturally. That gets so complicated for humans in hospital. It's nothing's natural about it.
Yeah,
they're having all these artificial things. So then even if you decided, okay, let's stop all the artificial things, even that sometimes feels too cruel because you've kept a person going to a point that they're so broken, their body's become so harmed, you know, like a has deteriorated so badly, if you leave everything go, you still might be 4 or 5 days of agony that maybe wouldn't have happened. So I was just thinking about that. So I actually
waited
out with my dad. I hoped until he passed away. Because the laws in Australia are a lot better than, better from the perspective of dying with dignity laws.
And choice.
And it was so good to be able to actually let him make a choice. And then be there, and so he didn't continue to suffer, because he deteriorated so much from all the medical intervention that he was in so much pain and distress.
Yeah.
It seemed awful to just leave him, to keep on going.
Yeah.
So the sort of natural, it's very complicated.
It's so complicated.
Because we've got all these different sort of factors.
Yeah.
I did also just comment about the animals, because I've had many of my clients go through the process of having to put down their animals, and they always do it with, I always feel so much for them. There's such love for their animals. They're the type of people that wouldn't go around killing anyway. Sort of like regular killers of things. And so I haven't had anyone not do it with sort of a real sense of taking real time to make that choice.
Yep.
And really thinking about the animals. The best, what's best for my pet.
What's
best for the animal. That's always the highest thing in the every time it's been like that.
Yeah, I think that would always be the case, because people love their pets. But then it's kind of putting that what would be best on our human
values,
and hard to know with people and animals,
Well, like people like pets more than maybe people, some of them.
Yeah. So I think it's never not coming from a compassionate place. I think that's for sure. But, yeah, that is the important thing.
I don't know, I thought you were, maybe you weren't suggesting this, but I thought this was really interesting, which is how much does the person who's witnessing the suffering, their suffering, play into the decision that's made?
Yeah, putting the witnesser out of their suffering.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of situations where I witness something and I'm like, this is deeply uncomfortable for me, like I want something to be
speeded up.
But it's like, that's not always appropriate. Like, I'm trying to think like of a good example of that. Like, I don't, but it's just, I don't know.
Yeah.
I just think that that's really interesting to consider.
Yeah. Thinking of our friend Brian, you know, when he was dying a few months ago, and his body was so messed up for so long, and he was really suffering, and he was ready to go, and it was just like this kind of waiting process, it seemed like. But it seemed quite nice that it was, nothing needed to be done extra. It was, but more like stopping eating and drinking, I think is what happened. And I think that's one of the best ways to very naturally. And it died naturally, so not kind of speeding it up, like I wish we could get this over with. And he might have even felt that, but he was willing to actually go with just waiting it out.
So did he request no food, no water? Was that,
do you remember this, Patrick?
Well, he actually he had such severe
many things,
and diabetes, and the heart wasn't, the medicines weren't working on his heart condition anymore, and so his blood pressure would get bad, and he wouldn't eat, and then his diabetes would get bad, and then his diabetes medicine didn't normalize his glucose anymore. So ultimately,
and he had all this arthritic joint pain.
Arthritic joint pain that wasn't relieved by meds anymore.
Mm.
Ultimately, I mean, he didn't say, I'm stopping eating, I'm stopping drinking. He went unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
His wishes were, when I get this one, don't bring me back.
Yeah.
And it was also the same with Catherine. You know, Catherine was a relatively healthy 85-year-old she got this brain hemorrhage from falling. And she very clearly said, if I can't have a, if my life can't be, you know, walking and talking and being friends or whatever the legal equivalent of that is, don't bring me back. And so at the point that she was unconscious and the doctors said, you know, there's no functional brain left, then you just, then the hospice just stopped the food and the water.
Oh, I remember when that she had these breathing tubes and they thought she might die right away when and they took them out and she kept going and kept going for another week. So, and I think that almost like that natural death due to starvation and dehydration or whatever is one of the most compassionate ways you could say it maybe does extend a sort of a longer term, slowly fading, but there's something about, nature taking its course that's even beautiful in a way. So, yes.
Well, we're going to move on. I still have a question about this nature
topic. Oh, nature taking its course.
The nature thing. Like, you have two examples, the deer and the fence. Like, you suggested, like, well, they could carry it away from the fence, and then you brought up, because, like, the fence isn't natural. And then we have the example of compassionate death or whatever it's called.
What is natural is the question,
How is like, okay, a human can decide to drink that solution because it's not their natural death, but what does Buddhism say about like how our own consciousness and conscious decisions are rolled into nature? Well, it's natural. My deciding to do it is part of nature.
Or not. And in fact, from a bigger perspective, everything, all of modern medicine is natural too, right? So I don't know what Buddhism says, but by natural, maybe that's not the best way to put it, maybe like, the simplest or the, you know, the least interference. Still, it's ambiguous. Most compassionate.
The deer in the fence, you know, I would get a better hearing. You know, get something. Somebody, or you know, even a guy with none. If it was really dying, suffering. You know, it's a call. But I think it's better than leaving somebody just suffering on its own, like just animals picking at it and. It would be suffering, it would be starving, it would be miserable for them.
I think that what you were saying was, for me, it sounds like radical acceptance versus, you know, intervening. You know, just, right, this is what's happening. I'm slowly dying, or I'm in pain, or whatever is happening is happening.
There's no definitive thing ever, but I think we do know that in modern times, the medical industry is, you know, there's been some, I think, books and shows on this recently about how the extent to which people will go to extend a life, even if somebody's like a vegetable, just because we can't stand the idea that they wouldn't be alive, and the millions of dollars it costs, even though they don't have a life. I think that's one extreme that we could, whether we call that not natural or whether we call it just like too extreme, to protect life. And I think it misses the compassionate point. It's like, well, is that person enjoying their life? They're not even conscious of it. So, but there's no definitive things, I think, as we see here.
I think what's so interesting here is in these extreme examples of keeping life really long, or on the other extreme of like, artificially cutting the life short with a drug, both of it has to do with the involvement of a third party that's deeply distressed by what they're witnessing. Mm-hmm. So it's the involvement of a person who's witnessing their ego rather than being able to maybe let go, if possible, in some way or another into the, I don't know,
Perhaps it's not most natural, but like least deluded. What's the least deluded way to go about this? But that doesn't make it very clear.
No, there's no, I think as we get into these issues, there's no clear answers, but it's good to reflect on the intentions behind it all. So just to like shift into another one, abortion is another big issue, right? It's in the, woven into politics. You know, I think, I imagine Buddha would be pro-life and pro-choice. Of course, Buddha is pro-life, in the literal meaning of pro-life, but also that there's freedom always. And so, again, in I think Tenzin Roshi has almost a little bit unusually strong statement in his section on this here, and he says, when women have come to him and asked about this, he'll say, almost inevitably, I'll say, have the baby anyway, even if you feel like you won't be able to support it, even if you have to give it up for adoption, if it's not, you know, especially if it's not like deformed, or I think that's where it gets even trickier, right? If you know beforehand that it's going to have a suffering life. So it's a huge question always.
Yeah,
but
and we chant in the Metta Sutta about born are those to be born.
Yeah.
Compassion.
Is that
a direction or a directive in Buddha?
Born or to be born, yeah, interesting. And this potential life. And again, thinking of, I think it, from a Buddhist perspective, the traditional perspective of rebirth is always, all of this is always just this, our life is this tiny little bit in this huge sequence of evolving towards Buddhahood, hopefully. All of us, right? So, it's like, for this being, is this gonna like, I think some of the things that are up, I don't know all the details with these arguments against Trump and Hillary about this late stage abortion issue, right? But I think it was about when you know that the baby will not, has some radical, issue that it will not have a normal life, then can you do this? And from this evolutionary perspective, it's like, well, maybe that will help it speed it up into its next stage. It won't be able to like practice so deeply in this life. But again, that's our human intervention.
The
donkey,
the guy who turns into a donkey and then
right, like that.
There's this guy that lived at Tassajara who was like, I have AIDS. And he's like, death is a natural thing. I'm just going to die of AIDS. And I'm not going to treat it medically. Hmm. And then later he's like, you know what? Like, I could help a lot of people. I think I'll take the medications.
Mm.
The medications weakened his heart. And he rang the wake-up bell at Tassajara and died in front of the front doors.
Wow.
It's like amazing. God.
Mm-hmm. That was just this last year, yeah?
Yeah. But what a way to go out. Like, he's going to be... he rang the wake-up bell and died. Like, he had to enter in the back door. He was the guy being like, everyone get up to meditate. And then, attack. Like, it's like kind of amazing.
Wow.
So, like, what was the right... where's that gonna
And you never know, like some people who are severely handicapped or something turn out to sometimes be these amazing examples for other people and really work with it in a beautiful way, and so we never know.
Yeah, it's hard, like when we're trying to figure out what a normal life is or a meaningful life or what life is, like in the case of before being born, like when it starts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How are we supposed to live?
Yeah. So I think just questioning our, you know, what's the compassion, like honoring the awesome mystery of life, and then from that perspective, then try to figure it out. Yes.
I guess I was just coming back to this thing that maybe we should just keep bringing the focus in the end back to reducing suffering.
Yeah.
Because you can just come up with so many arguments for one view or another about all of these things.
Yeah.
Like, I'm very pro-abortion. I think it, in the big picture, it reduces suffering a lot. You know, so I feel very, you know, I feel strongly. I've thought about it a lot, but I can respect the other view too, and I might be wrong. But I think if the perspective's coming from really trying to see what's going to reduce suffering and then being humbled by the fact that we can't know the answer.
We can't know, yeah.
And that's the best
answer,
rather than arguing what is actually the right thing to do or the wrong thing.
Yeah. It's never
really
right or wrong.
It's very emotional.
Yep.
So
yep.
Well, yeah, because you're put in a situation, obviously, if it wasn't an unwanted pregnancy, you wouldn't be in that situation, right? You know, it's something as if you're being attacked and you have to decide whether you're going to kill them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a situation.
Yeah, I mean, Reb says maybe it's somewhat naively, and I don't know where, if this is true or not, but he says, well, I tell these women, if you have to give it up for adoption, I know of many people who would be happy to receive your baby. I'm like, really?
And also, like, completely leaving out what it feels like for a woman to grow a baby in her belly and then give it away. I mean, that's extremely painful. It's not like...
But she wouldn't have to. I mean...
No, but so if you're saying... See, this is where it just gets, you know, gets very complicated.
Yeah.
If she wants to have the abortion when it's this big, then there's no... You have to get attached and all that sort of
thing. And that's a real...
Once it gets here, of course, the chances of you giving it away are going to be pretty small.
Yeah.
And then you've got a baby that you didn't actually want to have.
And also the suffering factor when it's just a zygote or something, we might say it's actually not suffering, and probably most people would agree, but it just has the, it's this weird theoretical issue, but it has the potential. And then,
Then there are, like, issues with methods of birth control, because technically a precious human life is the fertilized egg, but certain methods of birth control, like an IUD, would cause that leave each month. So
interesting. Yeah, yeah.
If you're gonna go strict, then you shouldn't even use an IUD.
I've thought of this also as like most eggs for sale. I think they're usually, or often, the healthier ones are advertised as fertilized eggs because they're supposed to be higher protein. I think most eggs.
Chicken eggs.
I have seen them advertised in New York City. It was crazy. Like, in Barnard, the publication for the women's school, they're $40,000 for women to donate their
But chicken eggs fertilized. I've thought of that being like, you know, in a way, kind of ethically, if they weren't fertilized, then it's like basically like a chicken's menstruation. You know, it's just, it doesn't necessarily harm the chicken. But if it's a fertilized egg, it's more like in the category of abortion. And maybe people never think about that with chicken eggs, but I used to think of that. I think it's easier just not eat eggs.
From a compassionate perspective, is they want the chickens and the roosters to be having a natural, normal life.
Oh.
Not the chickens all by themselves and the roosters.
I don't know if that's why they want to buy. I heard that they're like supposedly like a more complete protein or something. It's a health issue for them. So let's, as we still have time here, move from the human realm. That's a nice segue into the non-human realm of killing. And so we have the, and it's, you know, the precepts clearly about all sentient beings living animals. And so I think in the realm of like rodents brings up all these questions, you know, like now of course we have live traps where you can catch, and tasaharas, that's what they do, is you put out the live trap and you take them away, you release them somewhere else, and use repellents, not as much as you can, as opposed to rat poison that will kill them. And, you know, they're not as effective and efficient, but, you know, go out of your way. I think when it gets down to insects, it's a little harder to see. Maybe people feel like they don't actually suffer, and where's that gradation? And they're so small and insignificant, does it matter? But I think probably, like spiders anyway, it seems like they, we don't know whether they suffer or not. But I think just to see whether, like one criteria one might use to try to discern if there's some pain and suffering involved is if you try to go after an animal, even an ant or a spider, it will try to escape. It's trying to protect its life, whether it's not thinking the way we think. But there's this will to live, and I think that's something beautiful. This is my story now, but I think that will to live is like its Buddha nature. This, you know, and plants don't run away when you know. So I think there's something different with, and it's not, you know, sometimes it's hard if your sink's full of ants or something, what do you do? But in general, I personally enjoy, again, I wouldn't put it on others, but because I really do enjoy the practice of capturing the spiders and the mosquitoes and the bugs in a cup with a piece of paper, right? Very easy to do, and you know, you just take them out. And it's kind of like, it's a mindfulness thing, because it takes a little longer, but it's, I feel like it's in touch with the mystery of life. It helps me get in touch with the mystery of life. Take it out and put it down on a rock and you see it walk away, and it's like, that could have been just smashed right now, and there it has, it goes off into the wild blue yonder. And I feel happy about it. So maybe it doesn't matter to the spider, but deluded or not, like I feel happier about it.
Yeah. I do that with flies routinely, and very often they'll stay in the cup. Thank me.
Yeah. You have to kind of shake it sometimes.
No, I just wait until they're ready to fly. Mm. It doesn't take that long. Mm. But it's really nice. Cause yeah. I feel a sense of deliberate gratitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of them.
Connecting. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's actually a new thing you can buy now, so you can pick up spiders and stuff. My daughter sent me a link to it. It's like a little fibers that go out like that, and then you pull a little handle and they go like that. And so you can pick up a spider or a butterfly.
They're soft fibers.
Very soft. They're very soft, but they kind of tighten around it so you can pick things up.
That's
very nice.
Wow.
And just having it actually advertised on television. Don't like that spider?
So Jim likes to tell this story about you're playing the Mikugyo, and a spider crawls onto the Mikugyo. Do you like break the rhythm of the entire ceremony to save the spider, or do you just
hit it? Or do you go on the side? Yeah.
This thing, my friend has a mouse in her house right now, and I was like trying to tell her not to kill it, and I was like, well, the mouse doesn't know any better, and I was, you know, that it's bothering you. And I was like, well, what if it was what if the mouse itself was in a fortunate position to be like a human, and sure, like, it would be plenty nice to you, and if it was as fortunate as you were, more fortunate than you, I'm sure that it would gladly give you a meal or whatever, and not kill it, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, they're in this inferior position, and it's not their fault or anything necessarily.
Yeah, especially when they're like,
karmically.
I think that's so true. This is a nice way of just opening our mind, however much truth there is to it, but it's kind of just acknowledging it's not all about me, right? So mosquitoes too, we're like, why are they bothering me so much? Like, they're not thinking that they're like trying to annoy me, right? It's like, Yeah, they need to eat, and it's not like I'm breaking into someone's home it's really, and it's Kokyo's house, and I'm just gonna sneak in and do my thing. It's like, it's not Kokyo's house. Yeah. So we're like kind of sharing our strangely created human world of ownership and our ideas about comfort and all with these other creatures who are just, they're just doing their own thing. Yeah. So, and of course, eating meat is another issue where it's tricky because we might not be killing it directly. But I thought it's interesting to me that in these 48 minor precepts of the Brahmajala Sutra, the third minor precept prohibits eating meat. A disciple of Buddha must not deliberately eat the flesh of any being, for if he does so, he cuts off great compassion, kindness, and the seed of Buddha nature, and causes all beings to encounter her, to avoid her. Therefore, all bodhisattvas abstain from eating the flesh of living beings, because this is the source of limitless harm. And this is a minor precept, not on our list of major ones. So, and sometimes the Zen ceremonies bring up the minor ones. Even though it's not directly killing, it's like in this phrasing of like not creating the causes, conditions, method, or karma of killing. So if we really expand it to that, like being, you know, this larger sphere, and I think this is the kind of bodhisattva spirit. It's not just this literal thing you do. It's like, are we supporting this larger thing? Then it seems to fit in there more. And this, I really like, Peter Singer is this Australian philosopher, and Animal Liberation is one of his great classics. He has all different topics, but it's ethics philosophy. He's a professor, and I think he just has nice ways of talking about the philosophy. This is not Buddhism, but he makes the case for also, you know, animal testing, things like this. You know, cosmetic testing on animals and how we just use non-human animals in all these ways. He says, if a being suffers, there can be no moral justification for refusing to take that suffering into consideration. No matter what the nature of the being, the principle of equality requires that its suffering be counted equally with like suffering, insofar as rough comparisons can be made of any other being. If a being's not capable of suffering or experiencing enjoyment or happiness, there's nothing to be taken into account. So it's like, this is the issue, not whether, you know, other factors. So he says, the limit of sentience, using the term as a convenient, if not strictly accurate, shorthand for the capacity to suffer and experience enjoyment. So we could define sentient in that way. Which is different from, as far as we know, plants. But this is the only defensible boundary of concern for the interests of others. To mark this boundary by some other characteristic, like intelligence or rationality, would be to mark it in an arbitrary manner. This is a nice philosophical point. It's like, well, this animal is not intelligent and can't think, so it's lesser, but it's, well, does it suffer? So why not choose some other characteristic, like skin color, if it's something other than suffering? The racist violates the principle of equality by giving greater weight to the interests of members of his own race, where there's a clash between their interests and the interests of those of another race. The sexist violates the principle of equality by favoring the interests of his own sex. Similarly, the speciesist allows the interests of his own species to override the greater interests of members of other species. The pattern is identical in each case. Most human beings are speciesists. Where speciesist, speciesism is this new term, And he makes a lot of comparisons here to racism and sexism. It's the same principle. It's something that's different than us. We think it's not as valuable. And then, but to then use this criteria of suffering instead.
Or the interests of
the interests
of our species, like food.
Yeah.
It's of interest to us to eat animals for food.
Yeah. Of interest.
That interest we place higher than their,
yeah,
their interest for life.
Interest and not necessary. So like Richard the other day brought up this thing of what about when the tiger attacks the antelope, you know, is that not in accord with Buddha nature? And I think these are hard to say in these situations because it has no other way in a way for a non-human being that. That's the way it's evolved to live, and we, you know, people will make arguments, well, our gut is designed for animals, or our gut's not designed for animals, but in fact, it maybe doesn't matter, it's just that a different kind of mind that can make these choices, and we know we can live healthily now, in either way, so, and then the Jewish, kosher killing is interesting, and early Buddhism, Buddhist precepts was before the Bodhisattva precepts came on the scene was like the Buddha said I think it was more for the monks and that they were allowed to eat meat but except in these three situations and I think the situations if I remember right or something like that you haven't seen that somebody killed the animal for you you haven't heard that the person killed the animal for you, and you don't even have suspect that the person killed the animal for you. And if you don't, then you can eat it. And this is, you know, they're beggars, so they're usually, the animal wouldn't be killed for them, probably. It would be like the leftovers from the family's meal. They killed it for themselves. But if they did a special, like, we're going to kill the animal to have a feast for the Buddhist monks, then you can't have it. You can't eat it. So in a way, Buddha being very practical, so it wasn't really vegetarian. Later, this precept, as we just heard, is like, just don't eat it at all because it's too complicated. And I think nowadays, if we wanted to follow that old way, we'd say, well, if you buy meat in a store, in a way, if we're paying for it, it was killed for us. Like, we're paying somebody to kill it for us. Well, somebody else will buy it. Well, no.
Are you the same with Chinese and Japanese then too, as far as eating meat?
Yeah, so because this sutra is, you might have heard last week, was probably written in China, but in like the 5th century, so way back. But in Tibet, they don't have this sutra, so with this minor precept. And I think that this is was a major sutra. So, most Tibetan monks and other practitioners are not vegetarian, and I think it's also partly because the climate there is growing food. But I think I just met somebody this summer who, an American who wrote this whole book. It was amazing to me that he wrote this book in Tibetan. He's a Tibetan scholar researching vegetarianism in Tibet. And he found all these examples of yogis and teachers and practitioners who were speaking for vegetarianism, even though they were always in the minority. But he just, the word definitely was, people were thinking about this. But in China, in East Asia, so China, Korea, Vietnam, Japan, are all using this sutra from the 5th century on and still receive, most, except for Japan, most countries receive the minor precepts too. So those countries, from way back, we're like vegetarian. Almost the whole countries would become vegetarian because the whole countries were Buddhist. Like China was just, not exactly like the whole country was, but it was not just the monks in the monasteries, which were all vegetarian, but it was spreading into the whole culture. And this was way, you know, some centuries ago. In Japan, too, and over the last couple centuries, it's gone back, you know, the other way. And Buddhism's kind of on the decline, and meat eating's on the incline, even in Japan. Yeah, well, I think in Japan, especially, is there was this whole Reformation movement. And in fact, we talked about this last week, how the celibacy thing changed in Japan. And interestingly, they called this movement, this new movement in the 1800s in Japan, the issue was that they lumped them together, like marrying and eating meat. I forget the Nikijiku Saitai or something, and it was that they put these two together, and often people would argue for both. Now the priest should be able to marry and eat meat. So it was before the 1800s. It was like almost like law, and then it changed. But I think, you know, you could say, well, it's just because it's in the sutra or something. But I think it is a nice contemplation to like the effects of everything that we do. I heard one teacher recently say something like, buying the meat in the supermarket is a string that connects directly to the slaughterhouse. And I think that's a nice image of like, you buy this, it means like you're saying, I'm paying this much money to somebody down the line to kill an animal. And if nobody bought it, no animals would be killed, right? I could say, well, but people will buy it, so I'm just contributing. That would be different, I think, actually. So the principle is different, I think, right? Because then it's really like, yeah, I think from an ethical point of view, it's different, you know, from a health point of view or something, it would be,
in a dumpster, because you were like dumpster diving, would you eat it?
I personally, I haven't eaten meat in so long that I actually don't, it doesn't, I have a kind of almost like, not desire for, but almost the opposite. Like, so even like the mock chickens and stuff, when they look too much like meat, I don't like to eat them. Because it reminds me, I've developed a kind of aversion for it. So, but if I was starving or something, I probably would. Or roadkill, or something like that.
Yeah, roadkill seems
legit. So this term freeganism, right? Freeganism is like you're vegan as far as purchasing, but if you find it for free, you'll eat anything. Freegan is like, and it's a nice kind of ethically contemplated view of like, if I'm not financially supporting harm, then whatever. Then we might have health issues or something too. Yeah. So big issues. On this first precept, this is a big one. We don't have to spend that much time with all the others, but maybe that's enough. Thank you, and may our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.